Hello, everyone. This is John Marks. I'm the editor at copsalive.com, and you're listening to another edition of copsalive.com Audio Bulletin. Our topic today is creating peer and family support groups for law enforcement agencies, and I'm very excited about our guests. I actually have three guests on the line with me. From the Evansville Police Department in Indiana, I have Chief Brad Hill. I have Sergeant Dave Barron. And I also have Sergeant Barron's wife, Lori Barron. And just by way of a brief introduction, Chief Hill was appointed to his position in January of 2004. He has already experienced a 29-year career at the Evansville Police Department. Sergeant Barron is here because he was critical in getting their peer support team program started after he was involved in an officer-involved shooting in 2003. Lori, his wife, is a team leader of the Heart Hospital Cardiac Rehab Center in Evansville. And Lori is here because after a while, Evansville and Chief Hill and everyone realized that it was important to maybe extend some of those support networks beyond just the officers on the department to include family members of those officers. And so we're going to be talking about the importance of peer and family support for your law enforcement agency. And I would like to welcome all three of our guests. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Chief Hill, can we start with you? I'd just love to hear your perspective on why you found it important to have these resources available for your officers and what you feel that's done for your department.
Well, for a long time, we had standard operating procedures that dealt with officers that were involved in shootings. And the procedures were, you know, we thought were pretty good at one time, but we found out the more that we talked with officers that were actually involved in the shootings that there was a lot of things that we were doing that really made it increase the problems for the officer, the stress for the officer in the way that we were handling it, the way we were investigating it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started looking at those, and as you said in your intro, Sergeant Dave Barron was involved in an incident. And Dave was one of the officers that we talked with about that. He brought a lot of ideas forward about here's the way we really should do it compared to what we're doing it, the way we're doing it. You know, an officer might be sitting in a hospital room for hours and hours waiting to get blood tests after the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have anybody supporting them. We just found that there was a lot of gaps in the way we were handling things. And we also found that not only an officer-involved shooting is not the only critical incident that an officer goes through in his career. There are many other things that can impact on an officer stress-wise, emotionally, psychologically, including being involved in an accident,
right.
Investigating an accident where, somebody may have a fatality accident, or we had a tornado here in our community. Those type of things, we began to realize we needed to support the officers better than we were. As we looked at that, as I said, Dave was very instrumental in helping us bring this to our attention, to the staff's attention. Most of my best ideas, John, come from other people, and that's the way this was. I had people that were passionate about some changes that we needed to make. Dave, of course, in the peer support team, as we began to look at that, and we started off thinking, okay, we got it. We need to get officers, other officers that have been involved in shootings, and have them as being part of the peer support team, so that they could come up alongside another officer who's involved in a shooting. And there would be a lot better understanding between those two and support provided. Dave has done that on more than one occasion. And the good thing in Dave's case, he had an officer who happened to be our firearms training coordinator at the time, who had been involved in the shooting, and I think he was a great assistance to Dave after his shooting. But we're just trying to make it a lot more formalized than what it was in the past, so the peer support team was created. And again, we were still kind of focused on the shooting, and we've expanded on that to realize there's a lot more than just shootings that we need to look at. And then, of course, as you know, Lori, being the family member of the officer involved in this critical incident, that was a person or people that we as a department really didn't think a whole lot about and consider what are they going through after these type of incidents. And so Lori really provided a great perspective on here's what I went through the night that Dave was involved in his shooting. And so made her an ideal candidate for the family support team. Mm-hmm. And no one has been more passionate about that and creating that here at this department than Lori. And fortunately for me, I just have to let her go and try not to put too many roadblocks in front of me. I've probably been the slowest part of this whole process as they created the standard operating procedure changes for the peer support team as well as the family support team. Of course, Lori has worked with other wives of officers in creating this team, and we have three ladies that are part of the family support team who are married to officers that have been involved in critical incidents. Two of them were involved in shootings, and one of them was involved in a very serious accident where he was out of commission in the hospital for several months after this accident. So they bring a great perspective and a very compassionate heart to the family members that go through what they went through and the way they suffered by our department's lack of understanding, lack of thought about the importance of this. So I can keep on going forever, John, but if you'd like to throw in a word there, I'll let you.
Well, first, let me say, Chief, I appreciate your being here, and as much as you might want to minimize your involvement, I think it's fairly obvious to me and probably everyone listening that it really takes some strong leadership to allow these kind of things to develop, and I commend you on your foresight in recognizing those needs, or even if you didn't, listening to people around you and accepting some of those changes. So, you know, the whole reason we're here talking about this is that there are, I'm sure, many other departments that have done this, but probably not the majority of them. And so your department is at the forefront of something that I think is really critical for the future of law enforcement, and that is taking care of our human resources and recognizing that it's not just the people that we have working in our departments, but it's also the people that support them. And so let me be the first to say thank you, Chief, for your support in letting this happen. And I would like to hear from all of you about, you know, how did this come about? And for those people listening, how can they do the same thing or learn from what you've done and do something different? So, Chief, let me throw that back to you or maybe we'll throw over to Dave. Why don't we talk a little bit about more specifics about how this got started? And you know, I can't imagine this was easy. So what would you have to go through to get this done?
Well, after my shooting, the standard operating procedure that was in place, the initial investigation from the time the officer actually pulled the trigger to the time he got to leave work was 6 to 6.5 hours. there was some redundant paperwork. There was, like Chief said, you know, you're waiting at the hospital, figuring out exactly, you know, what tests they needed to take, and I just figured, you know, I wanted to get this stuff done and go home. Yeah. You know, after the adrenaline dump and after all that's finally passed and you're sitting there thinking about it, you're exhausted. You want to go home.
Yeah.
And when Chief Hill took over, my shooting was actually under a different chief.
Okay.
And when Chief Hill and his staff took over, they're very approachable. Myself and another officer that had been involved in a shooting a few years before mine, I guess, kind of became the squeaky wheel. And so we started talking to them, and they invited us into a staff meeting. They listened. They asked questions. And, you know, they made things happen.
We figured he would never shut up if we didn't go ahead and do something.
Well, that's a good thing. So where did you get your ideas? What resources did you draw on when you decided to start a peer support team?
Well, when I was at the hospital waiting, the other officer that had been involved in the shooting before, he was actually working off duty there, and he came in and he talked to me for just a few seconds, but I knew he had been there, he had been through it, and no matter what all the other officers had told me, you know, what he said meant something to me, so I knew other officers could relate to that when their time came, if their time came, you know, that they had to deal with a critical incident of their own.
And so it was kind of just based on your ability to be able to talk to somebody that you trusted and you recognize that maybe we ought to have some sort of resource like that available, even if the officer doesn't think to ask about it?
Right. We figured the members of the team had to have some credibility, in that, you know, they had been through something, some major incident. They had to have the respect of you know, the other officers, on the department. And from there, we were actually contacted by the chief. They had found some training in critical incident stress management and okay. critical incident stress debriefing. And, my initial goal was just to shorten the procedure after an officer-involved shooting.
Right.
And they actually decided or came up with the idea of a peer support team on the department and sent us to the training and got things going that way. So it's been a mutual journey for all of us, I think.
Yeah. So it sounds like you now send all the members of the team through this same sort of training?
Right.
And who's putting on that training?
Yeah, let's say, and we've been to some other seminars since then. We've expanded our training. One of the best seminars we went to was put on by the COPS organization, Concerns of Police Survivors. And
is that the Traumas in Law Enforcement?
Seminar, and I mean, it was just really fantastic for what we're trying to do.
Are you talking about COPS traumas in law enforcement training?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been to that. I think it's outstanding. So good job. Are you basing your peer support team on any other models, any other organizations?
No. We initially just kind of flew by the seat of our pants. And we've become a little more formal. We've developed a standard operating procedure for the department, and we've expanded beyond strictly officer-involved shootings. Like the chief said, we've had cops take things home more than just that kind of stuff. Like you mentioned, accidents, just about anything involving, a small child, that can build up over time, or any particularly stressful situation you might run into, and That's part of what we have to do. We have to recognize what is a critical incident. You know, what may strike one officer as a major critical incident to him may not hit another officer the same way.
So how does your agency handle that? How do you initiate? Can the officer initiate a call out or response on their own? Or
It can be we can be called out, or the process started by either an on-scene supervisor, the officer himself, and the officer's partner or friend. Anybody can contact us.
One thing we don't do, John, is we don't really make it an option for the officer.
Good.
The same way with counseling. If they've been involved in a critical incident, we make the counseling mandatory.
Yeah.
We make him, he can certainly choose which member of the peer support team that he can, that he wants to talk with, but we want him to talk to somebody, and we want him to go to counseling, and he has to take the 3 days off, the mandatory 3 days off, because we find if we make that an option, we're all the strong silent type, and I'm fine, you know, and we don't want to allow that to happen.
I would assume you have some sort of an employee assistance program or some sort of mental health component of your health insurance that is also a backup there.
Yes, we do. That's citywide, and that's who we use for these type of things.
And is there any kind of interaction or liaison between the mental health professionals and your team, or?
Well, I can talk to that a little bit. We're actually working with one of the members of the EAP association that the police department can go to. Ralph, one of the team members, several officers have very good rapport with him when they have to go to counseling. And so we're actually working with him now to develop an in-service that he's going to do in April, where he talks to officers and their families about communication, you know, how the stressors of being a police officer, being married to a police officer. So we've kind of taken that a step further.
Okay.
They have a good rapport with him, so now we're going to do some type of preventative thing also.
This may be a good time, Lori, to do a transition. Can we talk a little bit about how you guys ultimately expanded then to include family members?
Well, Dave said that, you know, after his shooting, I remember getting the call about, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning that Dave called me himself and said he had just shot somebody and he was okay. And I asked him if I could come to the police station to be with him. He said he had no idea and he had to go. So, of course, I tried to call a couple people in the police department to see if I could go down there. And everybody didn't think I could, plus, you know, it's locked. So,
right.
Finally, one of the police officers that Dave worked with, he called me and told me he would meet me at the police station. And I remember being put in a room by myself and just waiting for Dave to come in. And they didn't focus on me, obviously. They were focusing on Dave and the paperwork. And,
right.
You know, I remember thinking, who am I going to talk to that my husband has just killed somebody? That's not something that most people ever talk to about that. Also, since that time, the family member of the person that Dave shot has been in the cardiac rehab program that I work in. So every time that I see this person, you know, it brings some anxiety.
Right. Wow.
And I knew that I wanted others to have some things that I didn't. And Dave said about 3 days after his shooting, he realized that I was probably going through my own stuff, and he really hadn't even thought about that. So this is why I wanted other people to have a better experience and have someone they could talk to.
Well, God bless you for doing that. I mean, you know, it's one of those walk in somebody else's moccasins sort of things. I've certainly been involved in these kind of critical incidents, and you're right, all the attention is focused on the officers and resources at the department, and usually the news media is involved, so people are trying to deal with them. And I can see how easily the family would be forgotten, and yet I don't think anybody intended it to be that way, but nobody had even thought about it before.
Right. What's really cool now is that part of the standard operating procedure on the department is when the peer support team gets called out, a member of the peer support team calls one of us on the family support team.
Well, that's a good
and
idea.
And so, say I would get a call and they would say, Officer so-and-so has been involved in this. This is his wife has been contacted, his mom's been contacted, whoever the emergency contact is. And then I call them and talk to them and see, you know, tell them that I'm going to meet them at the police station. I'll be there with them during the whole process. And mm-hmm. then I, while that officer is going through everything they have to go through, I talk to them about this is normal, this is what they'll go through, this is what he or she might experience over the next few days or months. And then I'm that contact with that person that if they want to talk with me, you know, I check with them periodically for different reasons over the next few months.
Okay. It sounds like by necessity it forces you to make sure that the department's emergency contact information is up to date and probably gives a good opportunity for the department to kind of reach out and extend a welcome to new members of the law enforcement family, so to speak.
Right. What we do now is we talk to the peer support, some of the peer support team and family support team, talk to the new recruits about what's available, and then they've added a portion where the last day they bring their, invite their wife, their parent, their adult significant other, and we introduce ourselves and tell them our experiences and that we're there for them if they ever need anything.
Can I just kind of jump in here with something real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
When we were, or actually Lori was looking into the family support side, almost everything we found for families was involved on-duty deaths.
Right.
And also part of the family support team is we don't want, you know, somebody's wife or whatever sitting at home wringing their hands. You know, that's why, you know, they do come to the department and they're met by Lori's team and led through the process. And it removes, at least some of their anxiety. Answers a lot of their questions. And one of the things we do with the peer support side and the family support side is we let them know, you know, what kind of emotions, what kind of feelings, you know, that they may go through over the next several days and let them know that, you know, that what they're going through is normal, you know, because what they just witnessed or had to do is typically not normal.
Yeah. And I just want to reconfirm that now the programs are available for any kind of stressful incident, whether it's officer-involved shooting or a major disaster in the community or what have you. You've extended that beyond just the traditional purview of an officer-involved shooting.
Right. And, like the chief mentioned, we had a major tornado, hit here in the community. That we saw some things that night. I happened to be one of the first officers out there.
Mm-hmm.
You take things like that home. We've had some pursuits, or at least one pursuit where the bad guy crashed into an innocent party, and the innocent party died. And the officer, second guesses himself, things like that. And there's really, all kinds of incidents that officers can take home with them or have trouble dealing with or need help dealing with.
Right.
Yeah. And the research we did when I tried to research a lot of this is there were some things for some departments had peer support teams. But I found very little information of departments that have family support teams.
Right.
The COPS organization is fantastic. That was one of the best seminars I went to. But they're there for me if, Dave's killed in the line of duty, but there's so many other things that happen to a police officer while they're alive that need support so they can stay healthy, both physically and mentally.
Yep. Well, and believe me, I'm a full supporter of the COPS organization, but they have their hands full just dealing with the ramifications of officers killed.
Exactly.
And I agree with you. You know, when you actually look at the line of duty death statistics, more officers are killed in accidents than are murdered. And COPS supports all of those people, but that also leads you to believe that there are probably a lot of other accidents that don't kill officers that are equally traumatic. And then when you add on all the other kinds of things, I suspect anything involving a child, any kind of a mass casualty situation, there are so many things that officers encounter that create a tremendous amount of stress. And the other thing I heard one of you say, I think it was the chief, sometimes it may not be something that is as monumental as some of the things we're talking about, but officers walk away very traumatized, and I'm glad that you're allowing them to initiate or have their supervisor initiate activation of this support network because they may not be able to do it themselves.
Right.
You know, that's one thing we found, John, and Lori pointed it out to us, as well as some of the other ladies.
Mm-hmm.
Even something as simple as having the officer themselves contact their wife so that she can hear his voice and know, okay, if I hear him, he's okay. It's when other people are calling her and she doesn't know whether he can talk or not.
Right.
Anything, even that, something that simple makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I never thought of that either. And I know for family members, there's nothing worse than seeing the chief or a supervisor show up at your front door. And so I can imagine there are a lot of protocol issues that are there when somebody hasn't died and you don't want to scare them to death by initiating a call or coming to the house. So, you know, you've already talked about a lot of things that I never would have thought of.
And give you another example. The two other members of the team, one of their husbands was actually shot.
Uh-huh.
He's okay, but he was shot, and the other one was in the car accident. So when Emily got the phone call, that, you know, the other officer told her that he had been shot in the head. Well, you can imagine what her picture in her mind was like.
Oh, yeah.
And Nick didn't call her and tell her he was okay. Obviously, he was on his way to the emergency room, but it was not a life-threatening injury, and all the other officers knew that except Emily.
Oh, my.
So, you know, by the time she got to the emergency room, her mind was just going crazy. So one of the things that we did this year for the first time is we did, I hate to use the word mandatory in-services, but we did 9 in-services for the police officers to tell them about our experiences and, you know, choosing their words carefully when they talk to the families,
mm-hmm.
so that we, you know, aren't as stressed ourselves.
Right. Do you all have a chaplains program at your department?
Yes, we do.
Are the chaplains tied into this as well?
They are. We have actually 4 volunteer chaplains who are full-time pastors, mm-hmm. or priests, and they have been involved in some of the critical incidents that the peer support teams have been involved with, and they've been instrumental in the process.
Okay. I'm wondering if maybe we can talk a little bit about how to do this. For people that are out there listening that think, wow, this is a really great idea, we need to do something like this, let's talk a little bit about what obstacles you have to overcome. And Chief, I'm kind of curious. I think you were pretty courageous in, you know, letting your members of your organization kind of initiate some of this, but I would imagine in your mind and in the mind of other chiefs and sheriffs, there are probably some liability issues, some insurance issues, some things that many of us might not think about. Can you talk about any of the issues that the hurdles you had to overcome to let this happen?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've found out as we update any SOP or create a new SOP, it's much better for me to have the rank and file that are actually doing that job every day mm-hmm. be a part of the process of creating or revising the SOP. So many times, as command staff, we may think something sounds like, hey, that works, mm-hmm. and we come out with SOPs, and then a week later after we came out with it, the guys that actually do the job come to us and say, you know, that's not the way we do it.
Right.
So we've learned to try to get them involved in the process, which is what happened with this. You get some officers that have a reason to work on this and make it better because they saw how it was worse. But getting back to your question, we did get attorneys involved in the process mm-hmm. To look at the SOP to make sure that the way we were wording it was not a violation of one thing or another. As far as privacy, we're very careful about maintaining the privacy of anything that is being said to the peer support team or the family support team so that the officers feel comfortable knowing that they can share things without it being used against them. You know, obviously, there'd be a rare occasion where the officer would say something that would be legally obligated to present that to somebody else. So we're very careful about that. And as I said, in the process, and it was a pretty long process of getting that SOP in final form. And as I said, most of the work was done by Dave and his team, and Lori and her team, to get it in final form. But we did involve attorneys in the process to make sure that everything was up to snuff.
And one of the other things we did is from the family support team, since we aren't employees, we're volunteers.
Yeah.
What we did is we had a process where we interviewed. We interviewed with the chief and some administration and some of the peer support team. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like you're interviewing for a job. And that you interviewed, you learned about that person, and they were ultimately responsible for the selection.
Okay.
And the wonderful thing is you had several ladies that came forward for that, for this volunteer position, you know, to add to the what they do every day. So we had a lot of wonderful ladies to choose from.
Well, I think most agencies right now, especially with the economy the way it is worldwide, I don't think we could survive without our volunteers. And they do bring a whole perspective that goes beyond the normal law enforcement thinking, which really benefits all of us.
Right.
What about issues of overtime? And I would assume that the volunteers have to have some sort of identification for access to the police department and they're probably operating vehicles, whether they're city vehicles or not, on the way out to some of the call-outs. Did any of those issues become a challenge for you?
Well, they haven't been a challenge as of yet. They do, of course, have the IDs. Again, I think Lori was the one that designed the ID and put it together. So they have IDs. We are in the process, after having gone through a new security system here at the Civic Center, the process of getting our family support team volunteers the proper proximity cards to be able to get in after hours here at the police department. But that's one of the steps also.
And is there any problem with overtime? I mean, we don't get overtime, but the officers.
Right.
You guys accrue some, but that's never been a problem.
That's not an issue, and I'm sure Dave here has probably done a lot of stuff with absolutely no compensation whatsoever. He's probably going to sue me for that.
Well, how about can we talk a little bit more about the kind of training? Because it sounds like at the beginning you kind of pieced things together, but now that you've been running for a couple of years, do you have a sort of a formal training or orientation process for either the peer support team members or the family support members or both?
Well, as far as the selection process for a team member, like I said earlier, it's got to be somebody who's kind of been there, done that. You know, he's got the credibility with his peers. He's well respected by his peers. by his peers and, you know, and the administration. And as far as the training goes, there's the cop seminar, like I said out earlier, was outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was training in at critical incident stress management and stress debriefing, which is kind of the base school. And we also do sort of with new members of the team, kind of a mentoring, I guess you'd call it, where if one of us is called out, we call one of the new members to go along with us and kind of see what we do, how we do it. You know, that part of it is sort of like on-the-job training.
Right.
And anything that we find, you know, we also tap into the hospitals around the area of mental health. You know, if they offer classes on stress, suicide prevention, you know, we tap into those. A lot of those are free. So all of the officers are in the process of being trained in suicide prevention.
Yeah.
And that's not even on the peer support team.
Right.
So the baseline classes on stress management, critical incidents, and so we all go through that.
And as Lori said, we're always looking for any training that's coming along, and whether to send the peer support team. And generally, we'll end up sending the peer support team members and the family support team members to that training.
The other thing I was thinking is I suspect that for some of the family members, I don't know how much of an orientation your department does when somebody joins, but I would imagine there needs to be a little bit of orientation about the department and the way you do things and the way you don't do things. And I would assume whether it's formal or informal, there must be some discussion about the protocols for the family members.
Yeah. And one of the things that I brought up is the few times that we've got, because, you know, we might get called out like right now for a critical incident, or maybe something that we don't have to deal with tonight, but we follow up tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things I brought up when you talked about credentials is, or, you know, some way to identify you is, most of the police officers don't know me, and if I get called out 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, I don't look my best, and they're thinking, who is this person here? So, you know, that's when we came up with the IDs to wear,
right,
of the family support team, introduced ourselves to the officers, and then so we've got to know several of them that way. And then after a critical incident, we have a debriefing. The peer and the family support team get together and talk about, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, what we could have done better.
And one of the things that they also do, besides what Lori mentioned earlier about going to the new recruits, the peer support and family support teams have gone to all the roll calls, which you may have already mentioned, Lori, but the mandatory training for that. So they explain the process to everybody on the department.
Yeah, good idea. What about record keeping? Are you keeping statistics on time involved and trying to measure effectiveness in any way?
Well, no. Record keeping, no, definitely in the fact that
it's confidential.
We don't keep records of what we discuss.
Right.
But we really haven't done record keeping yet on statistics, which is a really good idea.
Well, you know, at the moment, you just became a national model because of this interview. So, you know, and I recognize that these are hard things to quantify. So, you know, like everything else, we only have a couple things we can measure. We can measure the time that everybody's putting in. The department probably wants to know what costs there are involved. And probably a lot of the success stories are anecdotal, but nonetheless, they're still valid if you start hearing from people, wow, this is so much better than the way we used to do it, and you know, thank you so much, you really, you know, took a lot off our minds by doing what you did. I would imagine that there are some ways to kind of quantify it.
Right. The nice thing is we don't have a critical incident here every day, so it's not something that they're being used constantly. and that's a wonderful thing. But it is something that keeping the statistics of how often they're called out and what they're called out for, I think the work that they're doing, like you said, often can't be quantified, the value of it with those different officers and their family members.
You know, this whole process for the family support team has taken about 3 years to get to the point where we are. You know, we could quantify in the fact of, you know, we got called out for, you know, last year, two officer-involved shootings, a drowning, you know, those things. But then it's so much far-reaching than that with the follow-up. I'll have, you know, we talked about this earlier, John, where, you know, a lot of police officers are married to nurses or people in healthcare fields.
Yep.
And some things that have happened besides my experiences, you know, in Dave's incident, the person he shot died. Well, there's officers that, you know, they shoot somebody and the person lives, or there's an accident and the person lives.
Right.
You know, some of those nurses have been asked to take care of those patients.
Yep.
And, you know, I have other officers' wives say to me, what do I say if they ask me to take care of this person? I say, you just tell them you can't do it. You know, there's a lot of other contacts we have that people don't even know about. And one of the things that we started 2 years ago was every emergency contact that the officer lists, we sent out a letter introducing ourselves and addressed it to them, not the police officer, and told them who we were, a little bit about our experience. They were there for them if they ever needed anything. And so last year we developed a sub-team of the family support team that meets quarterly, and this will be our second year. And then we just got done sending out letters a second time in January and told them a little bit about what we've done this last year, and you know, we hope they join our meetings and they have any insight, because it's not just wives. We have some mothers on the team. Right now there's no men, but hopefully one day there will be. And, you know, they offer suggestions, like they wanted us to do like a welcome wagon type information to the new officers that join, not just about what the department offers, but that we are here for them, a little bit about Evansville. A lot of people are new to the area. What can they do there? So, you know, we have a lot of other formal things in place, so... That would be great. I'll work on that. Try to quantify that.
Well, you reminded me also, we've talked a little bit about the COPS organization, which is Concerns of Police Survivors. And one of the things that I've heard from them is that a lot of times there's some support for those family members right after an incident, but then it sort of drops off. And one of the things they're working to build is, you know, kind of a long-term connection. And I'm wondering if that's been an issue for you, because you've talked about a number of incidents where, you know, there may be some lingering effects in the community even, where some of the things, there are all kinds of reminders out there about it. Do you guys, have you talked a little bit about, you know, how long do we stay connected? How often do we follow up and things like that?
Well, at our last debriefing, which was a few months ago, we did bring that up about, you know, we're doing pretty good at the initial, but how do we keep following up with that person? The officers, you know, they'll see him at work. Sometimes they follow up, but I don't think we're as good at that as we could be. I know the people that I have got called out on, I tend to, you know, think about them, drop them a note, give them a call. You know, some people want to talk and some people don't.
Right. That's the other issue.
And so I definitely think that we could do a better job of that. I just think it's kind of broad.
Yep.
And how do you narrow your focus and how do you follow up on that?
Yeah.
But it's like a death. You know, you get all the support when it first happens, and then a few months down the road, you don't get any support. And so we could be better at that.
Well, and I just ask, because it is one of the kind of things that, you know, it's an issue I've heard about, and I imagine it's a lot harder for the family team than the peer team, because, as you say, they're still connected by their workplace, and they have a chance to see and connect with each other daily, if not fairly frequently, but when you start bringing in family members or you start providing support to the family, they're not there all the time. And so I guess the issue is then how do you decide, you know, how long or how often to connect with them?
Yes, that's a good question. I think that that's something that, you know, would be a good thing to work on. That's on the list.
Yeah, it's certainly different.
Well, I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
I agree with you.
I think that, you know, you guys have already thought of so many more things than most agencies have, and I'm glad we're talking about these things because I'm certain that everyone listening can connect with something here no matter what. I mean, we've all been involved in all kinds of trauma and stress, and not every agency has a line of duty death, but there are plenty of other traumas that we all suffer, whether it's a, as you mentioned, an accident or a crisis in the community or an officer that's disabled or who knows what, but there are plenty of them out there. I was going to mention a couple of websites here, but before I do, I was curious if you guys, are there any resources that you want to refer people to or anything that you relied on, anything that you want to list or I can print in the written article that goes with this interview?
Well, I think like Dave said, that, you know, the Critical Incident Stress Management Foundation, that's a good one. The COPS organization.
Yeah. I've already put up a link in the past to the current traumas of law enforcement training, and I think they only offer that about four times a year. But I'll pull that link up and make sure that it's printed in the article that we write with this.
And, you know, the National Police Wives Association, that's kind of how this interview came about.
Right.
Someone else that is on the forum from Evansville was talking to another person out in California, and they were talking about family support, and she asked if she could give her my email.
Right.
And so, you know, we talked on the phone. Her and her husband are interested in working on this, Heidi and her husband.
Yep.
And
we'll refer people back to another post that we had on copsalive.com, and I'll make sure we have a link to that one, Heidi and Michael's interview.
Because, you know, through that, too, we shared the SOP that we did here in Evansville. I asked the chief if that was okay, and so we forwarded that to them so they could look at that on their department out in California. So that Police Wives Association was a good one also.
Okay. I wanted to make sure everybody could get in touch with you, and the Evansville Police website is evansvillepolice.com, spelled EVANSVILLEPOLICE.com. And Lori and Dave, I know you guys have just put up a website that is shieldoflifeandlovedones.com, and that's spelled shieldoflifeandlovedones.com. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And that's a place where people can contact you and maybe get a little bit more information about what you're doing and see if you guys can't help them get jump started with something they're doing in their agencies.
Yes.
Can you think of anything else, any other resources that you want to refer people to or anything else you guys want to say?
Well, I really think that anyone to start this, the first thing they need to do is recognize there's a need for their department.
Mm-hmm.
And when they recognize that need, go to administration, talk to them about that. We've had a great support from our administration. Find people that have been involved in critical incidents and, you know, do this. And if they recognize a need, they have good support, they have people that are interested, really no matter what size of the department, they can do this. Even if they have one person that's part of the peer support team or they work with the smaller organizations, work with two or three other agencies, you could combine your resources.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that you hit the nail on the head. One of the first major obstacles is to acknowledge that maybe there is a need for something like this, and then at least get somebody started on how to create it. I don't think that most agencies are oblivious. I just think that we're all busy and we're focused on everything else. And these are the kind of things that we don't think of until it's too late, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, I think it's important for any agency, and you're absolutely right. We weren't bad people on the Evansville Police Department. It's just things that you hadn't thought of.
Right.
And nobody had actually brought it to our attention to the degree that Dave and Lori and others, they did. And what they were saying made sense, and it certainly makes sense for any police department. And I think you're right, John. I believe you said earlier there's probably a lot of them out there that don't have this, and that's the value of this conversation. And Lori and Dave and other members have presented this to the Indiana Association of Chiefs of Police conference just this year, and received a pretty good response from that, from interest from other chiefs in Indiana.
Well, I want to commend all of you for what you've done, and I acknowledge that there are plenty of things to keep agencies busy from now until the next turn of the century. But I do believe, and that's the reason we're talking about this, that this is one of the critical things that may be more important than a lot of others, and it doesn't sound like it's too terribly expensive to get started, and it doesn't sound like it takes too many people to get something started, but it does take some initiative and some leadership, and I want to commend all of you for doing that. So I would like to thank all of you for starting this conversation on Cops Alive, and hopefully together we can all kind of keep promoting these ideas, because they really are for the betterment of law enforcement as a profession, and we really do need to take care of our people, and I thank you all very much for being here.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Hey, it has been my pleasure, and I want to thank all of you for listening. You have been listening to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin, and I just want to remind you that Cops Alive was founded to provide information and strategies to help police officers successfully survive their careers. We help law enforcement officers all over the world and their agencies prepare for the risks that threaten their existence, and we do that by helping you plan for happy, healthy, and successful lives both on the job and beyond. We think one of the best strategies for doing that is to create kind of a tactical plan for your life and your career, and Cops Alive tries to help that along with podcasts like this one, with training sessions, and with written articles to try to help you bring together ideas to share, because we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just all have to work together to try to help our profession. My thanks very much to the three guests we had on this call, and I look forward to seeing all of you again on another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. This is John Marks. Thank you for listening.